This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Here is CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Boy, aren't you lucky you live in New York City where you don't have to fill up your car all the time. What are the rest of us supposed to do out here, Jill?
Drive less? That's so hard. It's funny. Someone asked me this at work at CBS News, and they said, you know, the question went something like this. I thought that like $4 a gallon gas was the point at which people say, I'm just not going to drive so much. And I think that is true, but it was actually probably like a 20-year-ago number. And so the question is, when is it do people actually say, I don't want to drive so much? I don't know. I do know that, you know, if you can drive a little bit less, that's great. I've been hearing more and more that some people are saying to their bosses, yeah, I know you want us in the office 4 or 5 days a week, but, you know, these gas prices are killing us. How about 2 or 3? And a lot of employers are starting to say, maybe we can do that. But look, the vast majority of Americans actually need to be at work. About 80% of the workforce has to be in person. And for those people, you know, the quaint old idea of carpooling and trying to really make sure that you are more thoughtful about driving, those kinds of things are going to creep into our universe again.
I'm hearing things like there are a bunch of refineries down. This always seems to happen. And that if we were more friendly with Venezuela, for example.
Yes, I'd love that. Like, let us. Mad dictators are always good people to rely on when you're in trouble. So, listen, these are all constructs. You know, and the core issue, which we know, is that we have remained energy dependent for too long on, you know, petroleum products, and nothing has really changed that. Maybe we'll see an acceleration towards electric, and maybe this is the real kick in the pants that everybody needs to see, like, oof, this hurt. But, you know, it will not help us today.
Where do we stand now in terms of the health of the economy? Of course, the stock market is in a swoon. Have we actually entered bear market territory yet?
Officially, no. And I say that with that official tone. Bear market, which is down 20% from the previous peak, it's usually based on a closing level. And on Friday, we dipped below the bear market territory for the S&P 500, and we didn't close there, so we're close enough. You know, I got everyone's attention was raised. And by the way, if you are a NASDAQ composite kind of investor, you're somebody who really tends towards technology stocks, you've been in a bear market since March, so you know that. NASDAQ's down basically lopped off about a third of the value of the composite. Bear markets are part of being an investor. I'm sorry, I wish I could make it better for you, but that is the deal. And nobody gets out of investing without enduring a bear market if you're a long-term investor. The real issue is, you know, what are you going to do about it? Hopefully nothing. If you don't need your money within the next 12 months, leave it alone. And just know that when your money is coming out of your paycheck to put into your 401k or your 403b, you're buying at a discount. Who doesn't like a discount? If you're retired, because a lot of people will say to me, well, but I'm retired, I'm not putting new money into the market, then I think you've got a different question to ask yourself, which is, can I refrain from pulling money out of this portfolio right now? There have been a lot of academic people who are writing about retirement and saying, you know, we've talked about the 4% rule. Don't ever pull more than 4% out of your portfolio in a given year. And we've talked about the 3% rule. But the reality is, if you don't need to pull money out of your portfolio right now, it's probably better not to.
It just makes you feel so much poorer. Of course, that's the whole point, right? If we spend less, that's supposed to reduce inflation.
Yeah, well, that's the problem. You know, I think that the reality is that we have a larger issue that is facing us, and we are putting our hopes in the Federal Reserve, because this 40-year high in inflation is persistent, and the Fed is now attacking it. I think that Jerome Powell was pretty clear in his last press conference, and he said, look, this is serious. We're taking it seriously. The Fed's actions may push us into a recession, and also inflation itself may push us into a recession. Also, a recession, like a bear market, a normal part of the economic cycle. We just hate them.
Yeah. I saw a statistic that more subprime borrowers are missing loan payments, which is something that happened before 2009, right?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, if you look at all debt, amazingly, during the COVID recession, a lot of people paid down debt. You know, it was an amazing thing. But the higher risk folks, the folks whose credit scores aren't as good, they aren't doing quite as well. Because what do we know about inflation is that it is a real regressive state of affairs, meaning that the people at the lowest end of the income spectrum are most hurt by a recession. Because if you make $40,000 a year, the vast majority of your pay is going to rent, food, and gas. The three things that have seen big price spikes in the last year. So I think the concern is that those people fall behind at the moment when the job market starts to slow down. And, you know, there's not a lot to do about that, you know, in terms of what let me just say this. If we go into a recession, if we come to find out that the beginning of this year was the beginning of a 2-3-4 quarter contraction, the government is not going to be able to provide any help because of the vast amount of money it has already spent.
CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Jill, thank you.
A pleasure.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Monkeypox. Do we have to worry about it? Let's call in the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD, brought to you by MultiCare. So, monkeypox, what is it?
Monkeypox was actually first identified in a laboratory in Copenhagen, Denmark in 1958 in laboratory monkeys. But the first human cases were actually seen in 1970 in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Now, all of a sudden, there's been breakouts in 12 different countries around the world, sort of out of the blue, and they're all seemingly unrelated. So that's where the concern has come from and made its way into the news. Now, this is a virus in the same family of viruses as smallpox, but we actually eradicated smallpox in the United States. In fact, we stopped vaccinating for it in 1972.
Now, as I recall, smallpox was spread by touching or sharing blankets. So how is monkeypox spread?
Monkeypox, similar to smallpox, is thought to be transmitted from person to person by close contact with the lesions that have formed, these sores that have formed on the skin, or with other body fluids or contaminated materials such as bleeding. It is possible to get it through respiratory droplets, but not just from being near somebody who's breathing who has it. They would literally have to cough on you, and then you would have to have large droplets spread to you. And that's a possible mode of transmission. But just to compare it to COVID, this is far, 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 far less transmissible, and hence why there's never been any widespread outbreaks.
Okay, so it sounds like this is not going to be something else that causes us to shut down the economy again or have to return to mask mandates. It sounds like you can pretty easily avoid this.
Yeah, I mean, you look, unlike the SARS-CoV-2 virus, which, you know, we learned early on could spread asymptomatically, monkeypox does not usually go unnoticed when it affects a person because of the skin lesions it causes. If you want to know what it looks like, you just need to type the word monkeypox into your search engines and look at pictures of it. It's not something that's subtle. So although monkeypox itself isn't actually known to be sexually transmitted, certainly sexual activity would constitute close contact. But it's really unclear why it's occurred in all these different countries simultaneously and sort of out of the blue.
Right. But we're still talking about a very small number of confirmed cases, right?
The total number of cases as of a couple days ago was about 120 confirmed or suspected cases detected outside of Africa.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's pretty darn small. Is there any vaccine for it? Should it come to that?
The fact is that the smallpox vaccine is about 85% effective in preventing monkeypox infection. So, for those of us who were born before 1972 and got the smallpox vaccine, which was routinely given, we probably have 85% likelihood of being protected from of getting the illness or having serious illness from it. Now, since 1972, we've stopped vaccinating people, and so the chances of getting it are certainly higher. And overall, because we haven't been giving the vaccine now for, you know, 50 years, you know, it is possible that we will see some increase in the number of cases. But this isn't going to be another COVID by any stretch of the imagination.
That's good to hear. And this is not the kind of virus that can evolve the way COVID does, right?
Right. The smallpox and monkeypox both fall into a category of viruses that are DNA viruses, and they do not mutate. Mm-hmm. And hence, our current therapies and vaccinations should be from 50 years ago should still be effective today, whereas the SARS-CoV-2 virus, which is an RNA virus, can mutate rapidly and is therefore able to elude our immunity from vaccinations and previous infections and even therapies, which is why the CDC has recommended us keep getting all these additional boosters for the vaccine.
Okay, but monkeypox cannot do that.
Monkeypoxes cannot do that.
Okay, so between the very small number of monkeypox cases and the fact that the vaccines are already there and are effective, it doesn't sound like we have a lot to worry about here.
I don't think we do have a lot to worry about. I think the thing is, the last time that we ever were aware of an outbreak of monkeypox in the United States was in 2003. Then that was specifically associated when a shipment of rodents from Ghana spread the virus to pet prairie dogs in the state of Illinois, and it infected 70 people. But that was very specific. Animals that were infected, brought from another country, but specifically from Africa, and went to a specific pet shop, and people got it that way. Otherwise, we haven't really had this happen before in this country.
There are rodents being shipped here from overseas?
I guess. I mean,
I thought we had plenty of our own, but never mind.
We do. But some people keep them as pets.
Okay. Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
And on Mondays, we find out who's going to jail and for how long. Here's Claro News Radio's Hannah Scott. And this morning, we have an online predator who is targeting children and one of several people convicted in a shooting in Lake City. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning. Yes. First, actually, we're going to start with a case involving a convicted killer named David Nichols, who killed a woman in Caledonian Park back in 2019. And I had to think for a minute. I do remember this case, but then, you know, the pandemic came in. It yep. seems so long ago.
So he was arguing with some young women in the park, and then he stabbed one of them and hit her carotid artery, and that ultimately killed her. And he also went after another woman and cut her and tore her shirt. This fight was over. It was so pointless. It was just over nothing.
That's Casey McNerney with the King County Prosecutor's Office. He says, according to police
investigators, the defendant, who was sentenced on Friday, went to Cal Anderson Park and was there hanging around. And he offered to light the victim's cigarette. And she made some kind of derogatory comment back, according to witnesses. And he pushed her and she pushed back. And then it happened really quickly and he stabbed her and he hit the carotid artery. And that was what killed her. And then it was,
that was just it. That was just over a saying one. It makes you think, right? Like when you cut people off, I always think about this, if you're doing road rage or something like that, and people out there can snap over yeah. something like that. This guy had no criminal history, nothing like that.
Really?
And just killed her. Just went off and cut her. And
what's going to happen to him?
He is going to spend 16 years behind bars. He
wow.
was sentenced on Friday. Yeah. It was absolutely over nothing. Our next case is going to be this Lake City shooting. So this was back, if you remember, last year, there was quite a few shootings that were happening in Lake City. Mm-hmm. And this was one of them. And we're talking about a guy named Anthony Claiborne. This was April 29th, 2021 at 125th and 28th. And this happened after 9 o'clock. It was around by the library. He was just charged, though, with assault in the first degree. There were several people, I think, actually charged in this case as well. This was one of the last ones, I think, before they clean it up, because there was a lot of community meetings going on. and a lot of call for action. I know Deborah Juarez, our council president now, who was from that district, had done quite a bit to try to clean that up. So they did get that cleaned up. He was sentenced for unlawful gun possession, and it ended up being assault. He didn't kill anyone. Mm-hmm. So he, again, got 17 and a half years, though.
Clean it up. What was being cleaned up? Was there something that was causing this that needed to be cleaned up?
There was a lot of criminal activity. I know there was some issues with some, like, some homeless encampments in the area. Wow. And which is, actually, I'm going to do something on that here in the next couple of weeks. A lot of our crime over the last couple of years, when you hear about the shootings going up and things like that, they're not so much involving the gangs. The age range that we're talking about, it's not the late teens, early 20s in, you know, communities of color. It's homeless encampments. That's where we're seeing so many of the shootings. And this was part of that, I believe.
Yeah.
Next, we have our online predator, which is, I think we have one of these every week, if I'm not mistaken at this point, and they're so common.
Alan Aquino was convicted of communication with a minor for immoral purposes and also assault in the second degree. He admitted to touching a minor in an offensive manner. That was the language that he used in his guilty plea, and also said that he was talking to her, and this is a quote, for purposes of a sexual nature. This was more communication like we see a lot through Snapchat and Instagram. He was in his 30s when this victim was a youth, a teenager in an employment services program. This case escalated from there. That's how he met her. And this communication went on over several months.
So this, again, is several months, an adult with a teenager.
He had an offender score of one, which is pretty low on the statewide offender score range, which can go from 0 to 9+. So what state lawmakers have said is a conviction for this is in the range of 3 to 8 months, which a lot of people will say 3 to 8 months for you know, targeting a minor like this, that doesn't seem like a lot, but that's what state lawmakers have said. On the two convictions for the assault and the communication with a minor there, he was sentenced to 9 months overall on Friday, and then another 12 months in community custody with the Department of Corrections. He also has to undergo a substance and alcohol abuse evaluation and complete a sexual deviancy program. And he has to submit his DNA to the statewide criminal database and also has to register as a sex offender. So there's a
lot that he has to do there. So remember that's the CODIS that we always talk about when I do the stories on rape kits and why we collect the DNA. So that's always very important. But you often ask me about what kind of follow-up or do they get any help. Right. So that's the sexual deviancy program that he goes through. And that's several months long.
And it works?
That's the question I never get the answer to, right? Is anybody tracking that? So I'm still working on that answer for you. I will bring it. One last one I want to just mention is Elijah Bryant. This was, and I do remember this too, this was July 15th of 2020. Obviously a lot going on back at that time. But there was this murder, a home invasion murder in Sammamish, which is very, very rare, right? You hardly ever hear that. And there were three people convicted in this. And it was basically a home invasion where they were going to steal drugs. And they shot the homeowner, Fabian Alvarez, who died from that gunshot wound. A couple of other people have already been convicted of this. This was the shooter who did this. It was just a couple of days, the day before his 18th birthday. Wow. But he was charged as an adult, and he was sentenced on Friday to 14 years.
14 years. He was just going randomly house to house, or did they know something?
They knew something. I remember this at the time. It was everybody, because again, it was Sammamish. It was such an out of the norm thing. But 14 years, charged as an adult when you're, you know, a day before 18.
Yeah. Wow. Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah. Mm-hmm.
It is time for your daily dose of kindness, and this is sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. We're going to bring you an inspiring story from a Mississippi boy who has a critical illness, but Make-A-Wish stepped in. He's not wishing for himself, though. He's wishing for others.
I'm a person of hope, so when you come against a big mountain, you have to remember that you have a big God.
That's Abraham. In fact, he and his family help feed the homeless every month, make sure they have a hot meal.
It's always a good thing to do, and that's what I grew up doing.
And along with the giving spirit, he's also a fighter. Abraham was diagnosed in June of 2020 with aplastic anemia. It's a rare condition where the body stops producing enough new blood cells. It causes bone marrow damage.
I had my transplant 10 months ago on September 10th. I had it on November 10th, 2020. So, yeah, I'm doing good.
And Abraham was determined to continue his mission of helping the homeless. So he told Make-A-Wish Mississippi he'd like to do that for his wish. Linda Sermons with the foundation says,
"We were excited. This is our first philanthropic wish in our 20 plus years as a chapter in this state. So it's a huge milestone for us, but also this is the first meal that Abraham is able to serve.
It's just a blessing to see all these people getting fed because I made a choice. So yeah, when I leave, I'm going to feel happy. Feel joyful."
His wish was actually to feed the homeless for a year. They're going to make it happen.
7:47, and now from the G and Ursula Show, here are both G and Ursula.
Ooh.
Thanks for joining us, Ursula.
Oh, my pleasure.
I figure the more we appear together, Ursula, the less likely we'll be confused as each other.
Yes.
People are always yelling at Ursula for saying crazy things, but it's me.
Ooh, how times have changed.
I can hide behind our silky voices.
That's right. Anyway, G and Ursula were among the brigades of volunteers in orange vests who were cleaning up. I was driving down First Avenue South, and they were everywhere. Right. So how did it go?
Yeah.
It was amazing.
It really was. It was just so heartwarming to see the numbers of people who were there early on a Saturday morning, willing to give up part of their weekend to do something that honestly was just a great team building thing, but also just gives us pride in this city. And the spirit of, hey, we can do this. And we still believe in this region and particularly in the city of Seattle. So that was awesome.
Who was out there? Because I did see a picture. And often I wonder if it's the same type of situation when a politician appears and they pluck like their supporters and volunteers and put them behind them to look like supporters. I wondered how many were actual like citizen volunteers and how many were part of the political system to support Bruce Harrell's mission.
I don't know. We saw Mayor Bruce Harrell.
Yeah.
We saw him. He and his team. They were doing some cleaning elsewhere, and we met up with them. But as far as that's concerned, the majority of people that we saw and were around were people that were volunteering.
All right.
I think one of the coolest things that happened that I kept noticing is that as we were going around policing and cleaning up, did you notice that people that weren't even a part of the crew that were just kind of walking and they see us cleaning up, so they would go down and kind of pick up a piece of paper?
Really?
Too.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. Yes. So to give you an idea, though, of how many people jumped on this opportunity, when they first announced it about 5 or 6 weeks before the actual event, they kept putting on events and saying, we need 20 people, and they would just keep filling up. So initially, the goal was 2,000 people to volunteer. There were over 4,000 people volunteering.
Wow. That's incredible.
And we kept trying to find an event where we could have our listeners join us. And so we had the one that was in cooperation with the Downtown Seattle Association. We started at Westlake. 30 people signed up immediately. So our crew, we had a 6-block area where we were in charge of cleaning up. The other thing we noticed is it was pretty cleaned up.
Oh, I was going to say, what did you find? What were you cleaning
up?
Well,
I think we found a total of one needle.
One needle. Oh,
that's it.
One.
Good for you.
But anybody do graffiti? Did you do any graffiti?
Yes. So other groups did. Graffiti was not part of our mission. We wanted to. But there wasn't, you know, in that 6-block area, the graffiti had been taken care of. I mean, since the Harrell administration has been in place, they've been working on cleaning up downtown Seattle. So, I mean, I had seen it, you know, and I was kind of buying into this whole narrative of how destroyed downtown Seattle is. But we've seen some big progress, and just the amount of time that we spent on Saturday, it was impressive.
If there's that much demand, why not just do it every weekend?
Well, not every weekend.
Well, I think
once a quarter. Biannual Harrell's Helpers.
Is that what they do in Marshall Island, fam? Is that what y'all do?
And
y'all get out there, clean up.
I'll tell
clean
you.
Clean up.
In their golf carts.
If I'm walking up and down the street, And I see, because I'm near the high school, and you know, the occasional McDonald's bag is on this. I pick it up.
Of course you
good
do.
For you, Dave. Well, you know, since you said you were driving on First Avenue and you saw all these people, we could have waved you down. You could have opened your door and joined us.
He had an opera to attend,
I can't believe there is trash in front of $1 million home.
I was on volunteer grandpa duty, which takes precedence over anything.
That's true. Oh, there you go.
Biggest volunteer gig there is. So maybe they should do, Harold should do this by, call it Harold's Helpers. I feel like this could really be a Seattle thing.
Actually pretty good.
It is. That was pretty good. You know, I've got a career in marketing if this radio thing doesn't work out.
Mayor Harold has said he's going to do it again. I think that they were overwhelmed with the response. Yeah. And everyone who took part, we all had a great time, and everyone said we would do it again.
Beautiful.
It really
weather.
Was a team building thing. Yes.
It really was a good time. The energy was great. The people that were amazing. The folks, the volunteers that were organizing, they were amazing. And wait a minute, Westlake Park, they had who was the lady that was singing, Ursula? That lady was doing some good singing.
Don't know.
You usually know the singers.
I know. So they had a band there, so they had live music. But, you know, Coach Pete Carroll, he was down at Pioneer Square.
That. Did you see him?
We didn't. He was in a different area. But, I mean, they...
Tweet.
They there was a huge group at Pioneer Square. So.
And how about the snacks?
The snacks were fantastic.
They had snacks.
Wait, you had snacks?
Yeah, they had.
Now Dave's in.
They had cookies.
Yeah,
and
from Dahlia Bakery.
And peanuts.
Tom Douglas.
And, yeah, yes. They took care of you.
I just need to know, gee, did you do any cleaning? I know you said on the air you were more of a manager guy, walking around and meeting people prehand. I just want to know.
I was there to witness that G was in fact cleaning,
good.
Just
awesome.
Like the rest of us. So yes,
what are your
absolutely.
Cleaning shoes? Are they the studded ones or the red bottoms that you clean?
You know, I made it a point. I just regular Nikes.
Okay.
I made it a point. You asked me, was I cleaning? Here's what happened. I had the bag, and then all of a sudden it becomes a competition.
Right.
You
yes.
see what I'm saying? And so now you're trying to fill your bag up. Yeah. And I had Chef's son, Matthew, and I come, hey, man, when you get your stuff, bring it over here in this bag.
So then towards the end.
Stealing the child's trash?
Yeah. And then the last piece, I had this big old plexiglass thing that I found, and I put that in the bag, and it made my bag look big.
Oh. So you're looking for the biggest trash.
Right.
You got the biggest bag.
Come on. I
want to congratulate everybody who took part, and I know that the response is going to be even bigger. So, Mayor Harrell, do it again soon, because we can't do enough to try to bring people back downtown.
Can we join you next time? I'm just going to volunteer all of us.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Dave, you'll come with us next time?
I know how to pick up trash, G. I can also mold lawns.
Yes.
Prune
it's
trees.
About time for all that graffiti you've sprayed all over Seattle, yeah. Dave. It's time for you to give back.
G and Ursula, 9 o'clock on Cairo News Radio. 8:47, Seattle's Morning News. Get ready for another initiative. This one seeks to decriminalize small amounts of drugs. Let's go to Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott for the update. So, we're going to try this, are we?
Yes, and this is, you know, this is not the first time we've had this come up. It actually, if you remember a couple of years ago, and the people behind this, I-1922, by the way, are the same, I believe, to a certain degree, as who were around the original proposal, which I want to say 2019-ish is when it first popped up, 2020 maybe. They wanted to decriminalize small amounts of drugs. And then we had the Blake decision that happened when that was an initiative to the legislature. So they had kind of just announced that. And then Blake, which was the state Supreme Court, doing away with our felony drug possession law. So it was for a time legal to carry around any kind of drug you wanted if it was a small amount, you know, not for like mass dealing. Yeah. And then they had the Blake Fix Bill that was passed, not last this session, but the one before, which was legislature's temporary fix so that it wasn't just legal to walk around with these small amounts of drugs all the time, right?
So this would unfix the fix?
This would, to a certain degree, this would decriminalize, right? So right now what we're doing is we are working under the Blake Fix Bill, which is the, instead of a felony to have a small amount of drugs on you, it is now a misdemeanor. And it is a mandatory diversion for your first two times that you are busted with any drugs. And then after that, it's a prosecutor discretion. This would simply decriminalize, so you're not, there's no misdemeanor. There's no need for it. It's decriminalized.
It would go back to the way it was before there was the legislative Blake fix.
It's decriminalized though, so it doesn't. It's yeah, it gets a little technical, but yes, more or less, you can have any kind of drugs that you want walking around with them. Cops could still seize these drugs though under this initiative I-1922.
So the drugs are still illegal. You just don't get arrested.
They are decriminalized. So there's a it's a different definition.
So what are we doing this for? Is there some research behind this that says life will be better and
the
streets will be safer?
As with all great things, there is competing research on it, of course. So you have some who say that there's no research to back up that this is the right way to do it. But then you have a lot of people, and I think most people would agree these days, that the war on drugs is not working. Mm-hmm. It's not happening. But then you have, this is from debate over the Blake Fix bill, which was, again, seen as a legalization. This is Senator Ann Rivers, and you had a lot of people sounding like her.
The parents of my district did not send me to Olympia to create a situation where children think it's A-OK to do drugs. And that is essentially what this bill does.
And then I want you to hear from these two. These are both people with very firsthand experience about what we do now, or what we were doing, which is incarceration, and how that works.
I can tell you that prisons and jails do nothing to address substance use disorder.
I believe that the time and money spent during the 8 years it took me to get through the court system and my incarceration had been used for treatment and recovery services, my son would have had his mom back at 8 years old instead of 15.
So it took too long. Then you had Pierce County Prosecutor Mary Robnett, who explained this argument.
We have a very successful and robust felony drug court here in Pierce County, and felony charges serve as a real incentive, as a real leverage to get people who are suffering from substance use disorder or addiction into drug court and into very effective treatment.
Now, this is Sal Mangia. He is on the steering committee for I-1922. He also worked on I-502, which, of course, legalized our marijuana in the state, and has been with this decriminalization effort. And as far as that leverage argument goes...
Are we seeing that now? Are we seeing that the threat of being incarcerated is really driving people to get treatment? And the answer is no. If anything, it's the threat of criminal sanctions that are preventing people from seeking out treatment. I think that the social data showed that when people are given the chance without the threat of criminal penalties, they're more likely to seek out treatment. And so that's the goal here. And again, trying to figure out a different way of dealing with this public health problem other than using criminal sanctions.
So that's what I said before, right? You've got the competing studies, that kind of thing, the competing ideologies. I know a lot of people who would definitely disagree with what he just said there, that people will, of their own free will, be more likely to go to treatment on their own. That's just simply not true.
They need to be steered. Well, number one, they have to decide, I'm ready.
Right. And that's, but he's right. He said that point too. Yeah.
Number two, they then need to be steered through whatever system, whether it be the, you know, criminal justice system or our social mental health system, to treatment. But they're putting the cart before the horse. And I know not everything works out in like a beautiful linear timeline when it comes to the court system, but we don't even have the capacity to treat as many people that need to be treated.
I'm glad
with
you mentioned
mental
that.
Health substances. I mean, it's
no, I know.
Drives me nuts when
preaching
they're like,
to the choir.
Do we criminalize or decriminalize? We all agree they need treatment.
Right.
Where are the
but
treatment
then,
centers?
So take that further. So can you take the money that is currently invested into our prisons and our jails, right? And can you shift that into that treatment that
just
we don't
like
have?
That, I'm sure.
Maybe that is the better way to spend it. What they're going to do, this is also part of this initiative, is take, I believe it's $141 million annually from our cannabis tax revenue and put it into the treatment. So
I can see that.
That's more. But that's still, I can tell you, because I know the numbers, $141 million a year, still not good enough.
Right.
So is there ever a point where we can say you must go to treatment?
Never. Nobody ever wants to touch on that forced treatment. Nobody ever believes that that works, not under our current administrations anyways.
But if you've been arrested several times for stealing to supply your habit, don't we have a right at some point to say you must go to treatment? And for a change, we actually have a place we can send you to get
treatment. As long as you're okay with them getting treatment 5, 6, 7, 8 times. People cannot get better until they are ready to get better. You can't force somebody to be okay with getting better.
Then you have to take them off the streets.
What's an
then
addiction?
Then you put them in jail.
Mental
right?
health, cheating, gambling, all of that. The person has to decide they're ready to get better.
And it's true. They have to do that. So I can tell you this much. We're not going to have the capacity of the behavioral health system that you're talking about for several years still. So we'll see how it goes. This is an initiative in the signature gathering phase. So we'll see if it lands on the ballot.
Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you will never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.